Here are the headlines from San Francisco. Archibald MacLeish cites wide areas of agreement at San Francisco as guarantee that the conference will succeed. Alger Hiss predicts that work of conference will be speeded by end of war in Europe. Dean Gildersleeve advocates adoption of interim plans of cooperation to deal with economic and social problems until United Nations organization begins to function. This is the third of a group of State Department programs entitled Report from San Francisco, presented by NBC's University of the Air as a part of a larger series giving authoritative interpretations of our foreign policy. Assistant Secretary of State Archibald MacLeish is with us again as chairman. He will interview Mr. Alger Hiss, who is director of the State Department's Office of Special Political Affairs and is serving as Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on International Organization, and Dean Virginia Gildersleeve of Barnard College, a member of the United States delegation. Mr. William G. Carr of the National Education Association, a consultant to the American delegation, will also take part in the discussion. And now,
this is Archibald MacLeish. We've had many questions as to what effect the defeat of Germany will have on the conference here at the Golden Gate. I can say this. VE Day was observed quietly and soberly in San Francisco. There were no crowds on the streets. War workers, shipyard workers in their tin hats, Navy employees with their big identification buttons, went about their business as on any other day. I was interested in some scraps of conversation I chanced to hear in the streets. Well, that's two out and one to go. Or this. That's swell. Now we can really give Japan the works. For here on the Pacific coast, there is an acute realization that perhaps the hardest phase of the war is still to come. That, as President Truman told the nation, now we must crush Japan. The same spirit of quiet resolution prevailed in the conference. When the news of the surrender of the German armies in the West was announced by the Secretary of State to a late evening meeting of the British, the Russians, the Chinese, and ourselves in the Secretary's apartment on top of the Fairmont Hotel, the whole group of foreign ministers and advisors rose and stood for a moment in silence, in tribute to the Allied armies. That was all. It was deeply moving. And that was the reaction in the conference generally. I think everyone here realizes, particularly the delegates of the nations which have borne the awful burden of the war, that what victory in Europe means to the conference in San Francisco is not relief or relaxation, but an added obligation to get the job done. This city is not only crowded with the living, it is crowded also with millions of the dead of many nations. More than 172,000 Americans alone have given their lives to make this conference possible. To make it possible for free men to meet as free men to create a peaceful world. The delegates to the conference feel their responsibility to these dead more poignantly now that the war in Europe is over than they ever felt it before. They know now, as they never knew before, that they represent not the living only, but the dead. I don't mean to say that everyone here feels the breath of human hope that touches the days we live in. I suppose there are some here, as there are some throughout the United States, who are fairly cynical about this conference. Some who think of it not in terms of hope, but in terms of fear. Some to whom the motivating power behind the conference is not the new hope of the peoples of the world for peace, but the fears which have set nation against nation in the past. As though what we were trying to create was not a peace worthy of the sacrifice of all the dead, but an armistice worthy of the suspicions of the most cynical and self-seeking of the living. There are probably people like that here in San Francisco, just as there are people like that elsewhere in the country and in the world. There are always, at any moment of history, even at the great moments of choice, the great moments of destiny, men and women who are incapable of the human act of faith and hope. But certainly the great majority of the people here, whether they are members of delegations or members of the working press or observers and watchers, feel the hope and aspiration of humanity at their backs. And I, for one, am certain that the belief and confidence of the great majority of mankind will override the lack of faith and lack of belief of those who place fear above hope. Those who would betray this moment of possibility, this moment in which everything is possible, for the sake of partisan provincial hatreds or partisan provincial fears. Dean Virginia Gildersleeve, not only because she is the one woman member of our delegation, but because she feels the power of human hope as only a teacher can feel it, as convictions about these things. I'd like to ask you, Dean Gildersleeve, how you think victory in Europe has affected the conference.
VE Day has already produced a great desire to hurry up and finish our work here. I should think it might result in our adopting a simpler form of charter. That is, drawing up simpler outlines and not going into detail as we might have done if we'd had more time.
Do you think such complicated issues as trusteeship might be postponed?
No, but they might be handled in a more general way, Mr. McLeish. The details of planning the Economic and Social Council, for example, might be left to a special group if the remainder of the conference's work had been completed. But I think the major questions will be settled. In fact, settled all the faster, because of the sheer need to get home on the part of many foreign delegates.
Some chiefs of delegations have left San Francisco already, of course. Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov, China's Premier T.V. Sung, Belgian Foreign Minister Spak, and Norwegian Foreign Minister Lee took off this week. What effect do you think this may have on the meetings, Dean Gildersleeve?
They'll be missed, of course. But they're leaving capable deputies behind, and the work of the committees and commissions will go on pretty much as before. Most of the larger issues have already been dealt with.
Some commentators have been complaining that this is not a conference of great historic figures like Wilson. I think they rather missed the point. This is a conference of representatives of the peoples of the world. The real negotiators here in San Francisco, whether the observers here present see them or not, are the peoples. The opinion of the world is speaking here, and it seems to me altogether fitting and proper that it should speak through men who think of themselves not as world figures in their own private right, but as the people's representatives to do the people's work. One reason Versailles got into trouble was that there were too many world figures sitting around that table. This conference will succeed precisely because those who are present, those who were here at the beginning and those who will remain, do not think of themselves as world figures, but as representatives of their peoples, acting on the people's behalf. Alger Hiss is Secretary General of the conference. You probably know as much about its inner workings as any man in San Francisco. Let's have your views on how long it will last. Last week, Commander Stassen compared our meetings here with the convention which drew up the Constitution of the United States. That convention, I find, having looked it up, lasted from June 2 to September 17 of 1787. That's 3.5 months. Some people are asking, in view of the complicated job we face here in San Francisco, won't the task require closer to 3.5 months than the 4 to 6 weeks we've been predicting?
No, I don't think so. There is one big difference. Our Constitutional Convention started from scratch. We are starting with the proposals drawn up at Dumbarton Oaks.
Of course, the Dumbarton Oaks meetings were intended to last for only 2 or 3 weeks, and they lasted 7 weeks.
Yes, Mr. McLeish. But out of Dumbarton Oaks came the draft of a charter which requires only amendments and additions to make it workable. The Dumbarton Oaks proposals were before the nations of the world for 7 months before the conference began. After the issuance on March 5th of the invitations to the conference, there were 7 weeks of interchange of comments among the governments before the conference began, plus all the discussions that have been held at the plenary or full dress sessions of the conference since it began.
You were executive secretary of the meetings at Dumbarton Oaks, Mr. Hiss. How did they compare with this conference?
They were very informal. We didn't even call Dumbarton Oaks a conference. We called it conversations, and only 4 nations were involved there.
Do you have any late figures, Mr. Secretary General, on the total size of the representation here?
The last I saw, the figure was over 1,700. That includes delegates, their technical advisors, and clerical staffs. Then there are close to 1,000 members of the International Secretariat of the conference. 985 last week. Probably more now.
That's a lot of people. You might explain just what they do, what this International Secretariat, which is your special responsibility here at the conference, does.
It's the working staff of the conference as a whole. Very few people seem to know what it is. Let me tell you a story. The other day I was getting a shine at the Mark Hopkins barbershop. Chinese, British, and members of several other foreign delegations were in and out of the place. The bootblack said to me, "You must be on the American delegation." And I said, "No, I'm on the secretariat." He looked at me and he said, "I'm a Republican."
I'm not surprised. Very, Very little has been written about your work, yet you have done an amazing job organizing this thing from scratch, and, well, my memory has left me. How long ago was it, 3 months?
We didn't know that San Francisco was to be the chosen place until February 12th, when I was at Yalta. That gave us only 10 weeks to set up the meetings. I didn't get to San Francisco myself until the day before the conference. I had to stay in Washington until the last minute to complete arrangements.
But you had a couple of capable assistants on the ground out here.
I certainly did. The Deputy Secretary General, John C. Ross, started recruiting a staff as soon as the Yalta Declaration was published. First, we sent out an advance guard, and then more and more key people until the special trains left Washington. Mr. Ross had the help of the whole city, from Mayor Lapham on down. We had 2 direct teletype wires from the State Department to our office out here.
The operation of just getting the delegates here physically must have been a big job in itself, Mr. Secretary General.
The Army's Air Transport Command stepped in there and flew delegates from China, Saudi Arabia, and many other countries. The Navy provided flying boats and furnished buses to get the delegates around town after they arrived here. The chief of the Army Communication Service, the Signal Corps, set up a communication system as elaborate as that of any world capital, quite separate from the city telephone system. It has direct connections with most of the world's capitals.
That's International 3300, the number nobody will ever forget.
Yes. Our telephone switchboard averages 12,500 calls every day, or about 500 an hour. And the Army also furnished automobiles for local transportation and experts to record every word of the plenary sessions for use in translating and for posterity. All these things, plus arrangements for hotel space and meeting places and hiring hundreds of workers, were really handled in a period of less than 2 months before the conference.
What kind of people make up the staff of this famous secretariat?
The bulk of the staff is recruited from among Americans because few others were available in time. We invited all 46 nations to furnish personnel, and we have British, Belgians, French, Chinese, Canadians, and many other nationalities on our staff. Each of the 4 commissions has an assistant secretary general. These 4 are from Lebanon, Honduras, Liberia, and Ethiopia. And all of us are, for the purposes of this conference, without nationality. We represent all the nations at this conference, not the countries we come from. We do not participate in meetings of the delegations of our respective countries, for example.
I want to say, Mr. Hiss, that you have some remarkably efficient people on your staff. I've been admiring especially the work of your interpreters.
Incidentally, how many of them do you have?
Well, there must be about 25 or 30 in all. In addition to the translating at the meetings, of course, they must translate documents. We have 2 working languages, English and French, and 3 additional official languages, Russian, Chinese, and Spanish. The final charter will be written in all 5, and many current documents appear in all 5 languages.
Physical plant you have up on the 4th floor of the Veterans Building for printing conference documents is a sight in itself.
You've probably seen Lazy Daisy up there, the revolving turntable we use for assembling mimeographed material. That office works 24 hours a day, 3 8-hour shifts. Last Tuesday, they turned out some 800,000 separate pages. We are just finishing binding, in a separate volume, suggestions and amendments to the Dumbarton Oaks proposals in our 2 working languages, English and French.
I understand there are more than 700 pages of these proposals.
There were, originally, over 700 pages in each language. But in the end, by doing some summarizing, we got it down to 500 pages for each of the 2 volumes.
In addition to all that, which of the many meetings do you as Secretary General attend?
I act as Secretary of the Executive Committee of 14 heads of delegations and of the larger steering committee. And, of course, I attend the plenary sessions.
And then in your spare time, the meetings of Stettinius, Molotov, Eden, and Sung?
I attend meetings of foreign ministers of the sponsoring nations only when they meet as the 4 presidents of the conference on matters of procedure. When they meet as chairman of their delegations to iron out differences in policy, I don't attend.
Of course, the average citizen tends to think of these closed sessions as meetings in the well-known smoke-filled room, like the traditional sessions of the political bosses.
As a matter of fact, very little smoking is done.
Well, then what does a closed conference look like?
Well, as you know, the 4 foreign ministers' meetings are usually held in Mr. Stettinius's quarters at the Fairmont Hotel.
Well, then go on to the technical committees. You might describe one of those.
Well, the tables are set up in the form of a U. The chairman of the committee sits at the top of the U with other officials, with 30 or 40 people at the table. Advisors sit behind the delegates, sometimes just one, sometimes four or five, sometimes none at all. Attendance depends on the day's agenda. If routine matters only are scheduled, there are usually a lot of vacant chairs. If important matters are up for consideration, there is usually full attendance with a large number of advisors.
Dean Gildersleeve, you might explain just how the committee system operates from your point of view, as you see it.
Well, Mr. McLeish, as you know, each of the four commissions is broken down into committees, each of which has handed to it proposals and amendments to the Dumbarton Oaks plan falling in its special field.
Which committees are you personally on?
I'm on what's known as Committee 1 of Commission 1 on preamble, purposes, and principles, and on Committee 3 of Commission 2 on economic and social cooperation.
And how far have your committees gone with their work so far?
Well, I must admit that my committees have just got organized and have sorted out their work, so to speak. We've hardly begun the main job of making recommendations, although in my first committee we have agreed to use Marshall Smuts's draft of a preamble as a basis for that part of our work.
Let's see what remains to be done before the charter can be completed. Let me take a crack at it. The various committees, 12 of them in all, as I understand it, must finish studying the various proposals that fall in their fields. They must eliminate overlapping and make recommendations for the acceptance or rejection of the major proposals. Then the work goes up to the commissions, which are over the committees and which will have to pass on these recommendations chapter by chapter, and in turn send them to the plenary sessions of the conference for final approval of the entire charter.
That's right.
Now, I've been asked many times, and I dare say you have also, whether this won't be a time-consuming process. Many of these proposals are quite controversial and will be subject to debate. Several of the smaller states, for example, want to change proposed voting procedure in the Security Council. I should suppose debate on proposals of this kind would have to be translated once and sometimes twice, and if it is repeated on three different levels in the committee, the commissions, and the plenary sessions, won't it require several weeks to clear up even the major issues?
Well, I think it can be done fairly rapidly for two reasons. First, most of the debate will take place in the technical committees, which are relatively small, and where all the nations will be represented. If they do their spade work well, their recommendations will probably be accepted without much delay. Incidentally, the four sponsoring governments have already agreed on the Dumbarton Oaks proposals and on 29 proposed amendments.
From my point of view, that's the big news of this conference. But even so, and with all allowance for that, there will have to be full and free discussion at all stages.
Oh, of course. But I'm sure that a good deal of voluntary restraint will be exercised in the interest of reaching an agreement.
There's one idea I think it's important to get across here, Mr. Hiss, and that is that this conference is a rather complicated business. I get many letters and telegrams saying, go ahead, set up this international organization to prevent wars. Why this delay? People find it hard to realize, apparently, that we, the United States delegation, can't just make up our minds what we want in an offhand way and then just get it. That an international conference is a complicated matter of give and take.
But in another sense, it's quite simple, in that all the nations here are desirous of forming an organization that will prevent wars. Of course, as you point out, Dean Gildersleeve, it is quite complicated in the other sense of getting agreement on detail.
All you have to do to measure the size of the job, it seems to me, is to take any one of its pieces. Take, for example, a piece you are particularly interested in, Dean Gildersleeve, international cooperation in the field of education and culture. I'd like to explore that for a minute, both for its own sake and as an example of the conference's work. I've asked Dr. William Carr of the National Education Association, who is one of the consultants to the American delegation, to come in on this. I think I ought to explain to the radio audience what the consultants are. I don't know what you'd say, Dr. Carr, but I'd put it this way. The consultants to the American delegation are the most interesting and thus far the most successful experiment in democracy in the conduct of international affairs recently tried in this country.
I'd agree on both scores.
When we invited 42 national organizations out of the hundreds we wanted to come here to send representatives to San Francisco as consultants to the American delegation, everyone told us we had bought ourselves a barrel of trouble and that nothing would come out of it but headaches and disappointment. I don't blame the skeptics. It was a new experiment. The only point is that thus far the experiment, thanks, Dr. Carr, to the patient's considerateness and cooperativeness of the consultants, and thanks also, I think I should add, to John Dickey of the department and his associates, has worked. For example, the amendment proposed by the American delegation in the field of basic human rights came out of discussions, as you will remember, in which the consultants took the leading part. Now, naturally, the consultants and the American delegation don't see eye to eye on every point. Indeed, the principal usefulness of the consultants in this labor is that they bring to the conference the new and fresh points of view of great bodies of American public opinion. One of the differences between the consultants and the delegation occurs in the field of cultural and educational cooperation, and Dr. Carr has been particularly effective in presenting the consultants' view. I'm going to ask Dr. Carr to sail into this one and state the case as he sees it.
Well, rather than sail and state, Mr. McLeish, I would like to ask Dean Gildersleeve a question. But first of all, I want to say very sincerely how much my colleagues and I from the educational profession appreciate the opportunity that has been given us by the State Department to serve as consultants. Now for the question. The charter amendment proposed by China called for, quote, educational and other forms of cultural cooperation to be sponsored by the Economic and Social Council. But when our United States delegation approved this amendment, the specific reference to educational cooperation was struck out. Now, what is the reason for that?
Well, Dr. Carr, to be perfectly frank, I was very surprised to learn that the word education seems to mean different things to different members of our delegation. To some, it seems to have connotations of propaganda. There was some doubt as to what the reaction would be to an international education program, so we agreed to deal with the question in more general terms.
Well, of course, some dictionary definitions for education do mention propaganda. But after all, some dictionary definitions of culture mention bacteria. Really, after all, a recent public opinion poll has showed that 84% of the American people want an international agency for education. Now, I ask you, is there any other issue on which you could get such nearly universal approval?
I don't know of any, Dr. Carr.
Well, then what does account for the fear of the word education?
I suppose it springs from a variety of things. In the first place, there's the fact that education is not a function of the federal government in this country. With us, education is a function of the 48 states. Many educators fear anything that looks like federal interference with our state educational systems in this country. Some people carry this farther and object to what they see as possible interference with our American system of education by foreign countries. I've long been interested in educational exchanges with other countries, and I don't share this viewpoint, but apparently it does exist. We might ask Mr. McLeish to define culture.
I don't know whether I want to get into this friendly and sympathetic ruction, but I'll try it. Culture is one of the things you don't define. It's too close to life itself. You describe it. You begin, I think, by clearing your head of the notion which Webster's dictionary gives you that culture has something to do with taste and aesthetics. Maybe it did in the 19th century in the ladies' Browning societies. Actually, what you mean by the culture of a people is the life of that people, its civilization, its contribution to common civilization, the things its people value and the things they don't value, the way they make music, the way they express themselves, their habits of life, their works of art, novels, history, the things they have learned in their effort to penetrate the common mystery and experience of mankind by their various instruments, the instruments of science, the instruments of poetry. Briefly, what they are, what they do. When you talk about cultural relations and cultural interchanges between peoples, you are talking about the means by which the peoples of the world get to know each other, in terms not of news events, not of news sensations, not of political developments, but in terms of real things, in terms of themselves as people, in terms of their lives as people.
Mr. McLeish, isn't culture a rather cloudy term to the man on the street? And might it not mean different things to different nations? If we mean to include education, let's say so, as the Chinese proposed, by explicit reference. I do want to express to you the conviction of my colleagues that mutual understanding based on educational cooperation is vital to the success of the World Organization that this conference is building. Educational cooperation is not a minor gadget to be added to the machinery of international life later on. It is the motor which makes the machine run.
Well, you don't have to convince me of that. From a long-range point of view, it will be the basis for real human understanding among nations. Without that, we'll never attain a lasting peace.
If you take a look at the Chinese delegation here, you can see the mutual benefits that grow out of an educational exchange. 5 out of 10 members of the delegation went to American universities. When I meet Dr. Wellington Koo, for example, we talk as fellow alumni of Columbia University. And at a dinner with some of my Chinese friends the other night, I discovered that 6 of them had graduated from Columbia and 2 from Michigan.
Another good example is that of the Near Eastern delegates. 14 of the delegates from the countries of the Arab Federation are graduates of the American University at Beirut. The future of the world in the long run is going to depend on this sort of interchange, perhaps as much as on considerations of military security.
I was very much moved by a beautiful address at one of the plenary sessions by the speaker for the Lebanon delegation. He spoke about how the small countries couldn't contribute much to security on the military side, but how they could contribute beauty and art and science and culture generally to the world. And he spoke of the importance of educational exchanges. That man is a graduate of our American University at Beirut.
We have indeed accomplished a great deal by making American facilities available to students from other countries. And I think, too, that educational cooperation ought to be a two-way exchange. We can learn much from other countries. Now, what about the exchange of radio programs and motion pictures? Would cultural cooperation include that?
I should certainly say so. I feel that cultural cooperation program ought to make the interchange of good films easier. And the possibilities of radio interest me enormously. And this NBC University of the Air, which produces this program and others, is one of the pioneers in international radio education. Its programs are already broadcast to many countries. I think this sort of thing should be expanded. I'm sure most Americans would like to see some sort of assurance of freedom of communication between countries, such as freedom to listen to the radio.
Good point. There's been a great deal of discussion, too, about an international office of education and cultural development. Now that is what the educators want. We think it is not merely desirable, but essential, that the San Francisco Conference facilitate the creation of such an agency. And we think the evidence is that the American people want that too. Now, the Big Four amendments as they stand now would create a commission on cultural activity. Do you think such a commission would make an office of educational and cultural development unnecessary?
Well, I'd rather not have education under a commission on cultural cooperation. A specialized organization would be better. An organization that would be partly autonomous, like the United Nations Organization for Food and Agriculture, perhaps.
This was the third of several programs entitled Report from San Francisco, broadcast to the people of America by the NBC University of the Air, and to our servicemen and women throughout the world through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. You've heard Assistant Secretary of State Archibald MacLeish. With him were Dean Virginia Gildersleeve, a member of the United States delegation to the United Nations Conference, Alger Hiss, Secretary General of the Conference, and Dr. William G. Carr, a consultant to the United States delegation. The discussion was adapted for radio by Seldon Menifee. Copies of the program are available without charge. You may send a card or letter to our foreign policy, NBC Radio City, New York, 20 New York. If you have questions or comments on this series covering the United Nations Conference, you may send them to our foreign policy, NBC, San Francisco 2, California. We hope to devote our entire program soon to dealing with your questions. On next week's Our Foreign Policy broadcast, we expect to hear from other members of the United States delegation to the United Nations Conference. Assistant Secretary of State MacLeish will again introduce the broadcast, which will deal with developments to date at the conference. This is the National Broadcasting Company.